Hey, folks, welcome back to the Book Exchange Podcast. This is part two of episode 61. It's a double dip. Jude and I are both here. And as I explained in the last part one of episode 61, this is a Stephen King spectacular. We're calling it Stephen King Then and Now. If you didn't tune in or you missed our last episode, we talked sort of generally about Stephen King. And then the concept being, you know, we wanted to look at a very early work from Stephen King and then a much later, you know, more contemporary work from Stephen King. Talked about The Long Walk last time. Tonight, this is the now portion, part two. We're going to talk about one of his most recent books called Fairy Tale. And Jude is here with me on the phone. But before we do anything else, Jude, we are recording on the evening of November 11th. Today is Veterans Day in the United States, and I would first of all like to thank you and recognize your service in the United States Army. So thank you for serving the country the way you have, and we want to thank all veterans who may be hearing this, or even those who aren't, for their service to this great nation. So Jude, a former captain in the U.S. Army, thank you for serving on the line.
Well, thanks, John. That catches me off guard a little bit. But, yeah, no, I appreciate it. I find as I get older that people may pay more attention to this, and my service was brief. But what I like to say when people thank me for my service, and it happens more often than I used to, is I try to tell people it was an honor to serve the United States. You know, that's how I feel. It was an honor to serve. It wasn't easy. I joked with you today I wouldn't do it again.
Yeah,
but I think it's a noble thing to do, and I want to just conclude by joining my voice to yours and say thank you also to all my brothers and sisters in the armed forces that have served, are serving now, and in particular the combat veterans who really put their lives on the line, like our uncle and so many other people over the years. So thanks for that. I appreciate it.
Yep. Well said. So we thank our United States veterans for their service tonight. But now we jump into our episode. There's really no setup we have to do. If you missed part one of episode 61, we encourage you to go back and check it out, especially if you're a Stephen King fan. As I mentioned, last time we went over an early work of Stephen King's, The Long Walk. Tonight, we're going to start the show by talking about not his most recent book, because he's had another book released in the last couple months, and of course he has another one on the way, because that's just the way it is with King. He's so prolific. But this is a 2022 title called Fairy Tale. You and I have both read it, and we're kind of eager to share our opinions about it. And then when we're done discussing that, as I mentioned in the first episode, I have prepared sort of a list of really kind of softball questions for Jude here, my co-host, who is just more steeped in the work of Stephen King than I am. So we're kind of using him as our resident expert when it comes to Stephen King. I'm going to lob him some questions, and I think in so doing, we'll be able to kind of talk again a little bit more about Stephen King's body of work and maybe get into some corners we didn't get into before. So that's that. Normally on this show, we talk about what we've been reading, but we did that in the last episode. So Jude, unless you have anything else to say, I'll turn the ball over to you. You can say whatever it is you need to say, but then why don't you just kind of set the table for us a little bit and kind of describe this book, Fairy Tale, that we're going to discuss.
Okay, yeah. I just want to say, I know it's like a little tedious or whatever, but get in touch with the show if you want to. Email bookexchange with an X, bookexchange twins at gmail.com. Let us know what you think or what you want us to cover on the show. And we appreciate your contacting us if you want to. So yeah, John, you know, it's time to roll into part two of episode 61, and we're going to talk about Fairy Tale. You know, we've been, as we said the last time, we've been ready to do this for a long time, and you know, it's not all that often, unless we're doing something like this, where you and I both read the same book in a short period of time. And get the chance to exchange our views on it. Although going back and predating the show, John, we would do that all the time when we did read the same book. We would have like a basically the episode we're going to have now just between the two of us.
That's right.
You know, so carrying on with Stephen King. So we read Fairy Tales. John pointed out it's from 2022. And I remember when it was announced that Fairy Tale was coming out, I was like, man, this is going to be interesting because you could tell by the cover reveal and by the title of the novel that it was going to be, you know, more of a fantastical yarn. Now, that's not that unusual. As we pointed out last time in the oeuvre of Stephen King, there's an awful lot of straight up fantasy, particularly in The Dark Tower, but in lots of other books, you know, going as far back as, well, you could argue some of the Bachman books, but Eyes of the Dragon from the 80s is like a real fantasy dragon wizard kind of tale.
Right.
And as you pointed out last time, Stephen King is always making up these alternate worlds in various forms that all kind of fall under the umbrella of fantasy. But, you know, when we heard about this book, Fairy Tale, coming out, and it had this cover image with the boy and the dog going down like a spiraling stone well, you know, you kind of had a little bit of a flavor of what you were in for. Maybe more of a fantastical tale than something like a dark and bloody, you know, horror novel. So Fairy Tale is basically about – it's a pretty simple premise. It's about this teenage boy who's living with his dad in the main area, kind of like that's where Stephen King kind of sets most of his fiction. Not all, but most of it. You know, up in New England,
Let me pause right there, actually, because I think – I thought that this book was set, like, in the Midwest. Somewhere like Illinois.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right. Thank you for stepping in. Yes.
I was going to bring that up later, but I'll just say now that's fairly unusual. Maine is usually his default setting because that's where he's from, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Man, I'm off my game already.
No, that's okay.
But you're right.
All right.
Well, one point you made last time, though, was that, okay, so a lot of his fiction is set in New England, and John's correct. This is in an Illinois town that's not too far away from Chicago. So I stand corrected there. But John pointed out last time, it's interesting because, like, we talked about the American-ness of Stephen King and how a lot of the novels and stories he writes that are set in New England kind of feel like any town USA. We talked about that.
Right, right. Exactly.
But anyway, okay, so correction, we're in like Illinois, not far from Chicago. A boy and his dad, his widower father with no other siblings, are living in this small town in Illinois. And the book opens by recounting how the boy became alone with his father because his mother was killed in a tragic accident in bad weather, involving like ice and snow on a bridge, and his mother was out walking and she was killed. And that's set up very early in the story, just to let you, you know, the reader know why this young teenager and his father are living together. And his father has come through terrible alcoholism, and he's emerged from the other side of the alcoholism, and they're trying to just kind of pick up with their lives and continue. And the boy, whose name is Charlie Reed, I don't know if there's any, you know, meaning to his last name Reed, but his name is Charlie Reed, and they have this neighbor who's an elderly man who lives by himself in kind of a ancestral manse, or like a big old house that he's been in for a long time. They don't really know much about him because he's kind of curmudgeon-y and stays to himself. He has this dog named Radar, and he kind of lives up the lane from Charlie Reed and his father. And basically, one day, Charlie Reed is walking along the street, coming back from school or what have you. And the elderly man whose name – can you help me? Because the name is escaping me right now.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. We're putting each other on the spot here.
Yeah. I don't know. Is Howard something? Or yeah, they'll come back to us.
Yeah. I can't remember.
Which is pretty bad, but anyway, this elderly man.
What happens when you get 250 somethings who are hosting?
Yeah, no. I could look it up in a minute, but he has an accident where he falls off a ladder. He lives alone. He's lived alone for years. He falls off a ladder, and Charlie's walking by and hears him yelling for help, and Charlie moves in to help him, and that is the beginning of a relationship that he forms with this elderly man, who's kind of like this crotchety Fox News watching old guy with a kind of a mysterious past, and a dog, an old dog that's getting sick, that's kind of past its prime and also getting sick, much like its owner. And they just start developing this relationship where they slowly become friends, and Charlie, you know, starts doing things for him, and he helps him to recover from his accident, and they form a close bond. The only thing is, there's this shed in the backyard of this elderly man. I'll find out his name in a minute after I stop talking. He's got this locked shed in the backyard. Sometimes weird sounds come out of it. He won't let Charlie go in there. And eventually what happens is the elderly man recovers from his illness, but turns out he's sick, and then he passes away. He leaves Charlie some things in the house, as well as the entire house and all of his property, mm-hmm. and he basically leaves him some instructions as to what is the deal in the lock shed, and he asks him to go in there, long story short, and do something for him. And so when Charlie breaks the lock on the shed and goes into the shed, that is where the book moves on from out of our world and into a totally different world, a fantasy world. There's a stone, like I mentioned at the beginning, a stone spiraling staircase that goes down under the earth into some other world, and an entire fantasy novel with strange beasts and, you know, kings and, you know, creatures and stuff like that takes off from there, and then goes the rest of the 600 and something pages. So that's my basic setup.
Yeah.
How'd I do? Would you add to that?
No. I think you know, there's some setup in the book as well as in your setup there. Because one of the things we could say right out of the gate is, you know, he takes his time to get us to the cover image, you know, to get us to the other world.
Very much.
You don't get there until at least 150 pages into the book.
Yes.
And we'll talk about this a little more. That sounds like it's frustrating. I'm jumping ahead a little bit, Jude, but that opening part is actually one of my favorite parts of the book, but which may strike you as a surprise and was a little bit of a surprise to me, but I kind of enjoyed, you know, the growing relationship between the young guy and the old guy. But anyway, getting ahead of ourselves. But yeah. You know, it takes, you get the sense that he like is deliberately just sort of taking his time. You learn early that there's a locked shed and that there's something in there. He hears some strange noises. So you know from the cover that, you know, and the description of the book that at some point he's going to enter another world.
Right.
But once he gets there, you know, we can talk about everything that happens, but no, I think that sort of lays the table, you know, for the story. And I think what we should do is just maybe start by, I don't know if you were going to make any other points. If you were, go ahead. But I think we maybe just start with general impressions, you know, like maybe there's a lot that happens when he finally discovers that well, and he goes down and discovers this whole new world. I mean, that's like at least 2/3 of the book, but you know, we're not going to go beat by beat into the entire plot. We'd be here all day.
Right, but, right. And
yeah, go ahead.
And John, I think it would be a disservice to go beat by beat. We do when we discuss books on this show, I mean, we're going to give spoilers, we're going to talk about certain things, but really it's a little tricky in this case, John, because we're going to talk about the book and we will have spoilers, but part of the whole fun of a book like Fairy Tale, and King knows this really, really well, is the discovery. You know,
yeah,
like you're going with Charlie Reed, who's going into this other world, and he doesn't know what he's going to see, and you don't either, you know, like, and we can talk more about that. I thought there was a really nice way that Stephen King kind of, even though you knew Charlie was going into the shed and that it was going to go to some other place, there was one of these classic King, you know, sort of ending to a chapter that told you point blank, now you're moving into the crazy part, you know, like, and he has this way of doing that. That's like, it seems so, you know, sophomoric sometimes or simplistic or like a layup or something, but he's actually quite skilled at that. He just kind of, again, it's one of these techniques he does that just really keeps you moving, you know, and you're like, oh, I'm in, you know, let's go.
Yeah, you know, I think we talked about this a little bit last time where we touched on it. And I agree. I think it's all deliberate because I think he wants to, just in his whole career, really, the way he dresses, the way he talks, the way, you know, he's lived in the same town almost all along. And, you know, he doesn't seem to have traveled that much. He's not like a sophisticate, you know, like he, I think he just wants to be Uncle Steve. You know, he wants you to take a seat by his fireside or his fire pit in the backyard, and he's going to tell you a story, you know? And it's, and we talked about that a little bit before, but again, with this story, he just writes in a very casual style. He drops those references to brands that we all know. He drops pop culture references, and it's all deliberate. I think he just wants you to relax and hear a good story. And that's really, I mean, he said in an interview I heard recently, he was talking about, I forget how this came up, but he was talking about fear and scaring you. And he's like, you know, there's like really like deep-seated fear, like death or the fear of cancer or Alzheimer's. And then there's like the fear you feel when you go on like the funhouse ride, you know, or like, right. like the roller coaster or the funhouse, you know, the coaster that takes you to the funhouse. And he goes, and that's what I do. I create funhouse rides, you know, like that's literally what he said. And you're still there, right?
I am.
Yeah. So I'm kind of rambling on and on, but like, that's, you know, he's just, it's always in the back of his mind that he wants to tell a good story and he wants you to have a good time with it.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think it just, you know, that comes through from him kind of in every way. Exactly what you said, though. Almost his diction, his manner of speaking in interviews, right. Definitely in his sartorial choices. And he has very, very deceptively competent or, you know, excellent, deceptive excellence at doing that in the way he writes stories, you know,
right. Just
come on, pal. You know, he's like a carny or something.
Exactly.
You
know, like, I mean, he used the funhouse, you know, analogy himself. And so it maybe segueing into what we thought of the book, if nothing else, the book's a fun time. It's a good story. It's, I mean, we can get into it, but like, what, if you don't mind, why don't you tell me just sort of your general impressions? And if we could, let's try to, you know, situate it, you know, in his career, because we're doing this then and now thing, like maybe, you know, offer a couple of, you know, ideas or thoughts or reflections on, you know, this particular book at this point in his career. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So I'll do that at the end of my little short take on the book in general.
Okay, cool.
So, pardon me.
The floor is yours.
So let me just make some corrections here. It's Charlie Reed. His father's name is George. I got that intern working for us, John. He just handed me some notes.
Oh,
it's
about time.
About bloody time.
Yeah.
Anyway, the elderly neighbor goes by the name of Mr. Howard Bowditch, at least in our world. So that's what his name is, Mr. Bowditch.
That's right.
And anyway, so I found this, that is a good segue, because I found this to be, you know, a highly enjoyable Stephen King novel. I don't know if it's one of my favorites, but it's a very fun book to read, exactly as you said. And you kind of know that even before you even crack it open, just because of the title and the, you know, it's like, and the cover image, it's communicating exactly what you're kind of in for. You know, if you know Stephen King, you know it's going to get crazy. So you don't know everything you're in for, but you know the kind of story you're going to read. And on one of the, I think both of you and I did kind of some research for these two episodes, and I think the two of us both listened to a few podcasts with Stephen King that he went on at length about his career and stuff. And in one of them, so you might have heard the same point, in one of them he said that particularly, like you were asking, like, you know, in the latter half of his career, or in the latter portion of his career, he would consider a lot of his books to be YA books, young adult books, you know. But the publishers don't want to call them that because they don't think they will retain the, you know, the main fan base or whatever. this is a book that to me is it's squarely in that wheelhouse. And it's not, I don't think, you know, I don't think of that as a pejorative or like, you know, like a negative, John. Like when you say a book is YA, that's not going to give me too much pause. I mean, it just depends on the story, you know, because we both read great, you know, young adult books and we both read crappy young adult books. Mm-hmm. But this book is a very easy read. You mentioned last time it's kind of a warmer book. I agree with that.
Yeah.
A lot of that has to do with what you were mentioning before, the painstaking way that Stephen King set this whole story in motion. I think that was very much a deliberate choice that it went on for so long. Because mm-hmm. And I didn't quite like it maybe as much as you did. I thought it was pretty lengthy. But I also recognize at the same time that he was really trying to create this plausible and, you know, sort of deep in a short space of time bond between this young teenager and the elderly man. And I think he succeeded in doing that. I mean, he just went about it, you know, he took his leisure, but he succeeded in like creating this bond, which really, you know, kind of really drives everything that happens after it. So it was like mm-hmm. very deliberate, very conscious. But then, you know, and the whole book is written in the typical Stephen King style, which is very down-homey. Like you said, the brand names, colloquial phrases, references to modern technologies, references to old technologies, you know, some like really funny and ridiculous like pop culture references from both, you know, a long time ago and currently. And you just, again, you feel like you're around the fire with one of your neighbors. And then when he gets into the other realm is when Stephen King just kind of allows his whole very prolific, very strange and wild and crazy imagination to just really unfold. And you feel like every chapter of the book to follow, you get some kind of new and crazy concept. You don't even know if it all really hangs together. You don't really care. You know, like you're kind of going with the story and just hoping Charlie comes through. You know, he has a particular mission that he's trying to achieve in the other world, and you hope he gets there. And, you know, and you just kind of follow along, and it's sprawling, adventurous, sometimes very violent and bloody, but other times very just kind of warm and sort of almost silly almost, or just kind of what's the word that I want? Just kind of
like almost like cartoonish.
Yeah, or like, yeah, but there's like a comfort level there. You're just kind of, you know, it's a book. This is not a book that shakes you or rattles you or disturbs you in any way. This is just pure fantasy and it moves along and it gets, you know, by the time it gets to the end, it gets really crazy. Stephen King, particularly The Dark Tower, you know, it can just go crazy stuff happening. So you could expect practically anything, and you get a lot of almost anything in this story. But it just, you know, for me, it was like just a pure entertainment in the best sense. It was very easy to read. It was fun. You know, once you got into the other world, it really kind of moved. We can argue about whether it needed to be edited in certain places. Almost all King novels do, really, if you ask me. But this was just a pure good time, and I really liked it. I'd give it like a 7 or 8 out of 10. So that's what I would say by setup. And then as far – just really quick before I kick it over to you. As far as like, the, you know, fitting into his career, I think he has – it definitely fits into his latter career in terms of – and we'll talk about this more, but like, you know, Stephen King is so accomplished and so successful. He can do whatever the heck he wants.
Right.
He can take it any direction he wants, and he can go on as long as he wants. And you get that in almost all of his recent novels. They just go on forever. There's tons of exposition. There's tons of description. You don't necessarily need it all. You know, you got like long chapters. But he's so congenial that you're just kind of along for the ride. And you just kind of stay there right on his, you know, like one of those little cycles that have like the little seat next to the guy riding the motorcycle.
Yeah, you know, the sidecar.
You kind of just sit in that sidecar and say, you know, away we go, Uncle Stevie. You know, take it where you want to take it. So those are some of my thoughts. I don't know. How do you want to characterize your reaction to the book in a broad way?
Well, I think from this point forward, it's just going to be you and I doing what we do, which is just spitballing about the whole book. Because you said a lot there, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to touch on it point for point.
Yeah.
I want to mention that there was at some point in there, there was like a 3 or 4 second gap. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now. I think something disconnected, but it came back on.
Yeah. I was just saying that there was a 3 or 4 second gap in there where I couldn't hear anything from you. So, you know, adventures in podcasting, just like every episode we do, it seems like.
Yeah, that could have been anything. We may have disconnected in my house. I don't know, but let's just keep going.
Yeah, we'll see what people hear and what they don't. But there's a couple things you said, and I can't remember everything you said, but my sort of take on this is like, you at one point you said, building on something that I had said, that this is kind of for King, I feel like this is one of his books that has a warmer tone, and I can't help but feel like that's part of that is just that he's a lot older than he was.
Mm-hmm.
He's not the angry young man that he might have been at one point. That's number one. But you mentioned this, you know, like especially in the early part of his career, and especially when he was drinking a lot or doing other harder drugs, you know, and struggling with addiction. There's a whole run of books in there in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s that are pretty nasty. You know,
mm-hmm.
things like Cujo, Firestarter, the culprits, you know, trying to think of some other ones, maybe even Salem's Lot.
Yeah, The Shining is it's a much more brutal book than the movie.
Yeah, so there's like Nasty and Dark King, and we're going to touch on this later in some of my questions, by the way. But there's sort of like Nasty and Dark King, and then there's some books that are just like what I'm going to call Light King Light or Lighter King. And to me, this book, Fairy Tale, is like in the upper tier of Lighter King. If that mm-hmm. makes sense. Now, we already established, I have not read nearly as much of King as you, and certainly not as much of as many of his fans around the world. So there are plenty of, quote, lighter King books that I haven't even touched. Maybe Eyes of the Dragon is one of them, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, but from what I know about King and my smattering, I talked about the 13 books I've read. I've read some really nasty ones. I've read some more congenial or warmer ones. This is definitely on the warm spectrum. And we've already said it. I think part of that is by design. I agree with you. I think he really purposely, it's a purposeful slow build of the story. You know, that opening chunk, which is a good chunk of the book, is there for a reason. And a number of things. You mentioned about how you really appreciate how it slowly builds this, like, this relationship with the young boy and the older neighbor, the old guy, and it goes from being wary to becoming friends to then literally inherits the guy's house. So that's kind of a fun evolution to trace. But I also think that there's something going on with the relationship of the boy and the father. You know, he kind of carefully builds that too.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't help but think, and I have no idea if this is true, but I'm not saying it's true, but it felt to me almost as if King was imagining like what it could have been with his own father, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I know King doesn't know his father. I know he has negative feelings about his father with good reason because the father ditched the family. But I felt like, and this might just be me, but I had the feeling like here he is as a much older writer and he's saying, you know, what would have been like, what would it have been like to have a father who was supportive and a father who loved me, you know, I'm like, so I thought that was pretty interesting. Just the relationship between the boy and the father, the father really cares about the boy. And so that's what I mean. Like those aspects of the book were warmer threads than you're used to seeing in King's books, at least for me, you know? So I thought, you know, just having the first 150 or 175 even pages sort of be about, you know, focus on these relationships, even though it does lag the book. And there are certainly places where the book lags, you know, that's one of my complaints about the book. and we'll talk about another one in a minute, but it's, you know, it feels a lot longer than it needs to be. But I did appreciate that beginning, you know, like I just thought it was a lot. It was like almost like, you know, Stephen King Neighbor that was coming through in that opening chunk of the book. And I kind of appreciated that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it sort of might have been both conscious and subconscious. You know, the subconscious part you already talked about, kind of obvious, but, you know, Stephen King's whole, I mean, you talked in part one about how he was just really an expert at having coming up with some kind of crazy concept and setting the little wind up rabbit down, letting it run, you know?
Yeah.
And that's his whole MO through his whole career. You know, he's always worked in an organic manner, like he'll have some kind of scenario or setup and then just let it fly. But I think in this case, there might have been some design around that quality, like the warm quality and the slow pace of it in the beginning, and that, you know, the exploration not only of the Charlie's relationship with the older man that he didn't know, but Charlie's relationship with his father. I think that's, like I said, could be both conscious and subconscious. Subconscious in the sense that one of the little scenarios that Stephen King set up for himself in the story and decided to just follow and see where it goes is this idea of having the loving father who was an alcoholic who kind of recovered and what might have been. I think that was, you know, he followed that kind of subconsciously, but I also think he's aware enough as a storyteller that he knows that setting that warm tone and having that warm relationship between the boy and his father is also really functional and really works well with this particular type of story. Like if you're sitting down to write kind of a fantastic fairy tale, it makes sense to have kind of like warm elements or family elements or like, you know, comforting elements in the story, because that's what fairy tales are kind of like, you know, maybe not the, you know, the original grim ones that are really grim or whatever, but fairy tales in general are like these, you know, family hour type of stories, you know, like, and something for everybody to enjoy. And I think King was kind of aware of that also, like when he's wrote in these, like, you know, relationships that kind of mature and get closer and kind of tender in a way.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there was awareness and just also the willingness to explore perhaps some of those subconscious elements that you brought up. I think that's probably very legitimate also.
You know? And what you're right. I agree with what you just said. And what it also does is it gives the book stakes, right? Because like the whole time that Charlie's down in this alternate world, he keeps thinking about, you know, like anybody would in that situation. Like, gosh, I wonder, I don't know how long I've been gone because I'm not sure how time works in this alternate universe. But my dad's got to be worried about me, and he wants to get back to him, you know? So it gives that element to the story too. Now, if I can transition a little bit here, and we'll transition the discussion away, because I think we've talked enough about kind of the buildup, but then, so, okay, after about 175 pages, he discovers the portal or whatever you want to call it, the stairwell, you know, the well going down to the other world, which had been described to him in one form or another by the old man, Mr. Bowditch. And he finally gets there. And from that point on, like you said, most of the book is just Stephen King's imagination kind of running wild with this alternate world. And see, this is one of my criticisms of this book and of King in general, because you said it before, you know, at this point especially, he can do whatever he wants. He can go as far as he wants. He can make up whatever he wants. He can take the story in any direction he wants. I actually think that's kind of a liability, you know, or at least in part, you know, like, and we've talked about this before we recorded these episodes about how like King you said it, he's got no editor, he's got no filter, he can do whatever he wants. And so, but you feel it in this story. I think like it's always a good time when you enter an alternate world and you kind of, it's world building, which King is really good at, you know, he did it in The Long Walk. I mean, you know, he started doing it in the 60s and he's still doing it very well, but it can go anywhere And this book does in places, and some of it, you know, you just get the sense it's like, okay, we need to rein the story in, you know? Like, because it's a fairy tale kind of story, there's a driving narrative, you know, there's a princess involved, and Charlie, spoiler alert here, but Charlie may or may not be the long talked about prince who's going to come and kind of like deliver the people. Dude, it's sort of Toro's Spear in a way.
Like, I did think about Toro's Spear, yeah.
That's a little inside baseball, but that's a story that I wrote. It's come up on the show before, but it's an adventure story I wrote when I was like 12. But it's the same thing. It's like I was the main character. He finds basically some way in or entry into another world, and he helps another character on some kind of quest. It's the same story, you know.
Like, yeah, John, you know, like the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you know, like those four kids go through the wardrobe and it turns out that they're, you know, royalty and like it's a very similar,
absolutely.
You know, it's a trope. It's like a tried and true trope, which a lot of the things in this fairy tale story are. And right, know, to his credit, he's not hiding from those. He's working within the genre.
Oh, and know? He called the book fairy tale. So he,
yeah,
you know, yeah, it's signaled very clearly. The problem is he's got this wild imagination and no one dares to edit this guy. So like the rest of the book is at least 400 pages. I think it has a couple sections that go off in directions that really you didn't need for the story. And I'm thinking of the whole like quote unquote like prison part. Mm-hmm. Like there's a part where the main character gets chucked into a dungeon basically. And there's like a gladiatorial element, like, you know, like they have to go out and perform these games and rituals for like a crowd of, you know, upper crusters. And, you know, that's just one example. But I do feel like there's interesting elements in the imaginative world that he creates. But there's a lot of fat there, too. I don't know. Did you feel the same way?
Yeah, I don't know if I totally agree that, you know, that whole prison section, all of it, you know, was not necessary. It gave Charlie something to kind of like escape from, you know, and to like, you know, hear some of the backstory of the land that he's kind of stumbled into. But that section itself went on way too long. A lot of the characters were kind of thin and very unlikable. It just went on forever, you know, like when they actually got to these gladiatorial games, there were some very lengthy descriptions of like, you know, 12 rounds of fighting, you know, like, and, right, you know, right. You didn't need all that. And, you know, and then there were just some qualities to that part of the story that were kind of, King always has some really cool ideas and some ideas that are very silly, you know, and, you know, the ones that are better ideas, they're often brilliant. The ones that are really silly are often really silly. Like the guards had some kind of like electricity flowing through them. It didn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, like
right.
That the prison guards were like electric. And the way that they killed them was, you know, they discovered that they had electricity. So they just dumped water on them. You know, that right. Barely holds water to me. You know, I mean, again, it's all in fun and it's all in a very fun and fast-paced story, but you're kind of like, you know, whereas some other ideas like, you know, fantastical ideas that I thought were cool were like these strange butterflies that are like flying around the world and you never kind of knew exactly what was up with them, but they would kind of show up at different moments and it was kind of strange for my money, kind of interesting or, you know, him coming upon this mermaid in like a fountain, but the mermaid is like decomposing, you know, and it's like somebody had killed it. And it's kind of, I thought that was dark and kind of wild. You never really find out exactly what happened, you know, but there was like some cool fantasy elements and some kind of ridiculous ones. And overarching all of that was the fact that, you know, he could just write and go on for as long as he wants and nobody stops him, you know?
Right. Yeah. You bring up some good examples there. I'd forgotten about the mermaid, but that is a wild little aspect. And then I agree with you on the like the electric blue warriors or whatever, like they almost felt like stormtroopers or something.
Yeah.
Like
yeah, it was kind of ridiculous, you know, like you know, why why is electricity running through the? I just didn't, you know. Just, but King has a lot of that. He has tons of that. It's all over the Dark Tower. There's just some weird stuff, and you're like, what? You know, like.
Yeah, again, he's just letting his imagination sort of run wild, and nobody's like reining him in, so he can just do what he wants. But
right.
Speaking of things that like little aspects of the world I thought were cool, another one is that, and this gets revealed subtly, and I don't even remember the full reason for it, but you meet inhabitants of this world, and they have, it's almost like they're being erased from existence. So like features on their face are becoming blurry or not there anymore, you know, like
sliding off them or something.
Yeah. Like, or their mouth is not a mouth. It's just a blur. Or in one case, a character just doesn't have ears. And there's something like the world is deteriorating because they're waiting for this. It's like, you know, there's a prophecy sort of like, it's like all the, you know,
it just chucks in everything, you know, like,
yeah, like Charlie, but I did that too with Toro's spear. It's like there was a prophecy and, you know, Toro was supposed to come and find the spear and everything would be copacetic again, you know, like,
yeah, right.
and John Lovell had to come in and like, you know, help save the day. So like, you know,
right. You know,
John Lovell, Charlie Reed, what, why not? But, and there's a lot of that. You're right. It's like my story was definitely influenced by C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia and like King's drawing on that whole. And that's great. You know, so there.
Yeah, but I want to give a little plug for your imagination, John. I mean, John was like 12 when he wrote Toro's Spear. And, you know, he went, you got it, John, I got to give you credit because you went for the gold ring in that story. You put a lake of fire in that tale from like Revelations or something, like, you know, he had a lot of really fun stuff in there.
I'm
like,
glad you caught that because I'm sure I was consciously drawing from the book of Revelations, you know, when I, but anyway, it's like, I'm just some, you know, nameless hack, but I was drawing from the same well of stories that he is. That's the point. You know, he's like
drawing
from this pool of tropes and, he does add in some cool elements, which we've already discussed. And then, I don't know, this is just a side note, but like at one point there's a female giant that appears and then you find out that the female giant has like a daughter. And this is just me, like maybe just my nerdery, but I have to ask you, like, did you think of Grendel and Grendel's mother from Beowulf there or not? Because I really wonder if he was like consciously drawing on that or it just is a coincidence, but like, I don't know. I couldn't help but think of that.
You know, Grendel way better than I do.
Yeah. That's from Beowulf, by the way, for people who don't.
Yeah. That's from Beowulf. I think I sort of, this is a strange answer, but I think I kind of subconsciously thought of that. I was thinking about the beasts or the villain's mother, who's like even worse, which comes from Beowulf for sure. But you know, like to the larger point, like, so if you consider that a nod to Beowulf, this is where King is both so likable, but also can go awry quickly is because he'll just jam the entire kitchen sink into stories like this, you know, and he's done it again and again. I keep mentioning the Dark Tower. I mean, the Dark Tower, one of the books from Dark Tower, the snitch, the golden snitch from Harry Potter, like the Quidditch matches shows up in the middle of one of King's Dark Tower. I mean, you know,
I can't believe that. That's crazy.
It is crazy. And part of that was like, they had this whole relationship, Rowling and King, and they were like kind of standing alone on the, you know, the Mount Olympus or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, King was like, I'm so big, I can just take from Joe's novels, you know, like whatever. But anyway, so, you know, like there's this whole element in, Fairy Tale John. I mean, there's a huge debt to H.P. Lovecraft. You know, most of the climax of the story.
Good point.
Comes from H.P. Lovecraft for sure. It was like an obvious like riff on H.P. Lovecraft stories. But there's a riff on Rumpelstiltskin. There's a, you know, and again, in fitting with the theme. But, you know, part of what makes his book seem bloated, though, is like he'll have a lot of ideas and he'll try to stuff them all like into his stories of this nature. And then there's another quality to like him writing in a bloated manner that's not as applicable to Fairy Tale, but that we might get into later, you know. But he has no, He has no borders. You know, he's got no, like, those bumper things you put on the bowling alley, you know, for, like, little kids. He doesn't have those. And I think that, like, he's just – and it's been that way forever. And I think that was, like, almost a business decision. I know he has an editing process. He's mentioned it in podcasts. Like, there's an editor who reviews his books. But, you know, I think from a business standpoint, they said just let him do whatever he wants, because it's like classic business 101. The people are going to buy it no matter what he says, you know?
That's true.
And I think there's – I ran across this funny quote from the another sort of very prolific and very popular writer that writes big books, Ken Follett, John. The guy who writes those historical novels. And there was an article, because he had a new book out recently, and there was an article in the British newspaper. The headline was like, you know, Ken Follett says people still have an appetite for the big books. My bank account is evidence. You know, I think it's a business decision. They just said Stephen King early. The guy can write whatever he wants. People are going to buy it. And they're right. Like, they were right. So, but that the experience of a reader, especially, I hate to say this, but like kind of a discerning reader, you know, you have to decide if you're willing to put up with all that or not. I personally find it fun, but a lot of people wouldn't.
Well, and I think what Follett is describing there, and where King certainly lives, is a kind of rarefied air where, you know, when you become a brand, like Stephen King or Ken Follett or J.K. Rowling you know, there are other examples too. You can kind of do what you want, you know, and people, your fans are, when you have enough fans, they're going to come out and buy the book, you know, for sure. So there aren't many in that camp, but Follett is one of them, and King is one of them, and Rowling is one of them, et cetera, you know. But there aren't many, but you have to appreciate Ken Follett's candor there.
Right. I mean, he's not lying, you know?
No, I mean, I don't know how much more we need to say about Fairy Tale. I thought it's definitely enjoyable. It's a little bit bloated. If you're a King fan and you've read some of his other big books, I don't think you're going to mind. I thought it was just a nice example of kind of, again, I'll say it again, because I don't know how else to say it. Just sort of warmer King. And there's some, you know, kind of touching elements to some of the relationships in the book that you don't often see with his books. And like you said, he keeps the pages turning. I was getting a little impatient at points in the book, but when I closed the book, I thought, you know, that's a fun story. You know, it's like I said, it's like King Light, but, you know, executed with some of the skill and combined with the just, you know, congenial and relatable, you know, style that King brings to it, that just makes it, you know, fun and not too heavy. You know, some King books are ugly. Some King books are heavier. This one is just kind of a funhouse ride, like he described before. So that's sort of my take on it. But it sounded like there might have been at least one or two other aspects of the book that you want to touch on before we wrap this up.
Well, I can wrap it up. I mean, I sort of generally agree. There is one criticism I want to make of it. It's kind of specific. It's going to make me sound like a prude, to be honest. But, you know, I think Stephen King, like, I was a little disappointed and something he did in the book. He did this a lot early on. I would have thought he would kind of almost outgrow something like this. So you have to deal with when you read Stephen King books, a lot of sophomoric, you know, sentences or humor, sexually related or otherwise, you know, offhand references, occasional just cringe kind of line, whether it's about sex or not sex or like some kind of, I noticed in his older books, he'll have more like dad jokes kind of things. You know, he'll be like, well, you can call me whatever you want, but just don't call me late for dinner or something like that, you know, which has no place in like a fantasy world, or like, it's just kind of like some silly cliche, but Then towards the end of the book, I don't know if you stumbled over this, John. It was you literally would have to stumble over it because it was very unnecessary and not important, but he couldn't resist doing it anyway. I was kind of like, oh, man. But he does it all the time. There was a scene towards the end of the book where, you know, it's kind of wrapping up and they kind of have escaped the main danger. And there's this one ancillary, female character who really didn't have a much role in the story. And she basically says to Charlie, like, you know, before you leave, you know, I don't know if you remember this, like, I kind of got to show you what's what. And, you know, would you like to, you know, have sex with me or whatever, you know? And then so he just tossed in at the end there. He goes and he has sex with this woman just to kind of forgive my crude line, like bust his cherry or whatever, you know, like.
Right.
And that was so unnecessary. Not only was it unnecessary, but then he kind of – and this is – King does this, but this would turn off a lot of readers, you know. I mean, I don't care if there's sex in a book, you know, like with – you know, although a lot of times Stephen King will have like sex between very young people and older people, which – has occasionally gotten him into a little hot water. But then not only that, you know, like it was just totally unnecessary. There was no need for Charlie to, you know, escape from the fantasy world, you know, having lost his virginity. Yeah. Just didn't have anything to do with anything. But then the next chapter was like, forgive my language, friends, but it was kind of like, you know, he wouldn't call it like a sympathy fuck, you know, but he like that's the way he was writing. You know, yeah. Like, but he, and I was like, what is he doing this for? I mean, I know why people like sex in books and like, you know, like, but that was wildly unnecessary. I was kind of disappointed by it. I wasn't surprised by it, but I was like, well, that's stupid. And it did harken back. I know we're transitioning soon to kind of a broader King discussion, but it brought me back to one of the most disturbing or controversial aspects of one of his major books, which was in It. Do you know where I'm going with this? Do you know what this is?
Yep.
Yeah. So like at the end of this wasn't the movie because he's still, even in 2022 or whatever, you can't do this, you know, especially in 2022. But spoiler alert, at the end of It, there's like, there's a losers club with all these kids. There's like six or seven boys and there's one girl and the girl they all decide kind of together that to seal their bond forever, they're all going to have sex with her, you know? Yeah. Like in like underground or whatever, in one of these caves, and they're like 12, you know?
Yeah.
Like, terrible. So that's just a horrible choice and idea. And I honestly can't believe that he's been very criticized for that, but, you know, he's not going to get canceled. You're not going to cancel Stephen King. So, you know, but anyway, that wasn't necessarily a fairy tale. There were some other things that I had quibbles with. But by and large, though, I agree with you. When I finished it, I thought, well, that was a fun book. You know, it was a good time. I got lots of laughs out of it. There was some stuff that was just batshit crazy. For me, that's fun, and it was kind of a good time, you know?
Yeah, and I had forgotten, even though it's been like 3 weeks or months since I read it, but I had forgotten that there's like a whole sort of H.P. Lovecraft element that he throws in there too.
Oh, yeah, very much, yeah. Yeah,
so that's that's both kind of fun, but it speaks to what we're talking about, that he just throws in everything that he can. Whatever he thinks of on the day, he just tosses it in there. But, you know, your criticism there about the scene where he has sex with one of the natives of the world is just reinforces what we're saying. You know, there's like – there doesn't seem to be someone there to say what we're saying, which is like, you know, Steve, you don't need to put this in there. It's like has nothing to do with the story.
Like, nothing.
You know, so, yeah, you know, we're making the same point, which is that, you know, he's like so a lot of times throughout his career, and then we can kind of wrap it up here and we talk about his career, but a lot of times throughout his career, you know, he's wildly successful. He's the most best-selling writer in the history of the planet. And he's like a river with no banks, you know, it just spills out everywhere, you know?
Yeah, totally.
So occasionally, just like being a parent, just like any many other situations, you know, it's a good idea to have some borders, you know, sometimes, or have some banks to the river so that it just doesn't spill out into everything. But I think we're both on the same page, though. Fairy Tale was a good time. And, you know, one of the warmer books you're gonna read from Stephen King, at least up to this point. There may be more in the future. Who knows?
Yeah, and a great example of how expansive his imagination is and how fecund, however you say that word.
Yeah.
His imagination is fertile, like you just crap can grow everywhere, you know?
Yeah, and it seems like it has a different vibe or mood than something recent like Billy Summers or
oh yeah, very much,
you know. So that's pretty cool. You know, he can still bring it in a lot of different, you know, modes.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's take a quick pause. We'll take a quick break and then we'll come back and we'll just talk some more General King to kind of wrap up this whole two-part discussion. What about that?
That works for me, buddy. Yeah.
All right. We'll be right back. All right. We're back, dude. And I think that was a pretty good discussion of fairy tale. You know, there's a lot that goes on in the book that we didn't discuss, but readers can go discover that for themselves. And now, you know, for the last part of this discussion, this two-part discussion on Stephen King, I prepared just a bunch of questions for you that are, as we've said already, they're just going to kind of get us a little bit more into King's body of work. I'm going to maybe more specifically from your side, just because you're the kind of more experienced guy here. I'm going to ask you some questions about your own experience with reading King and some of your own opinions and stuff, and I'll offer mine, and you know, other our fellow book nerds can just listen in as we talk about it. So how's that sound?
Good. I think I can handle that. Yeah, like we'll just sort of segue. I mean, you know, we said in the first round that we could talk about Stephen King for kind of a week every night, you know. So right. We'll get to some of those other points and some we won't get to, but we'll just can hopefully it'll be kind of a good general wrap on Stephen King and what he does.
Well, there you go. So my first question is it might sound like it's going to retread some of the ground we've already covered, but then I'll ask something just a little bit more specific. But Jude, here's what I want you to do. I want you to imagine, like, you're talking to my wife, for example, who you know very well and known for years, or someone like other friends of ours that you can probably think of, but just the type of reader who is just like, you know what? King's not for me. Maybe, you know, my wife might not be the best example because she doesn't read a ton of fiction. But let's say you're talking to a good friend of yours or anybody, somebody you meet at a party. It's a big time fiction reader, but they're like, you know, Stephen King, horror is not my thing. You know, they kind of give you that line, the sort of cliche, what people know King for. But it becomes clear that the person has an aversion to Stephen King, or just is like, yeah, not for me. How would you try to win that person over to why should they be reading King? Okay. That's the question. Like imagine somebody like that. What would your argument be to try to be like, well, you know, you need to give King another look. And then the second part to the question is where would you have that person start? Like, what would you recommend that person read who's coming into King literally for the first time? You know, maybe doesn't want, you're not going to start them off with like, you know, something particularly nasty, but you're trying to make the case for King for this specific person. You know, we already made it for this show and this episode, but try that on for size. Like, you know, maybe where would you start somebody who's like, nah, I don't think King's for me, and be like, well, you know, why don't you try it? Where would you start them?
So would you like me to answer with where would I start him in terms of his work first or make more of the general case, as you were saying, towards the top there?
I think you can quickly kind of make the general case, but then maybe like think about – I have some picks. You're not alone in this. I have some picks that I was thinking of, and we could kick them around, but like where you might start somebody like that. But you can do both.
Yeah, that's really hard, you know, like
– Yeah.
I think, you know, as far as like, you know, why should I read King? I, you know, that seems like a waste of my time. You know, I like reading sort of, I don't know, people might say writing or, you know, literature that's more worth my time and effort. I certainly get it because I like reading, you know, heavier writers too. I can think of kind of one really easy, simple one and one that's like a little bit deeper. So, and I'm not making anything up that, I mean, it's backed up by my own experience, but King has talked about this stuff too. But the first point I made it kind of in the last one, I'd be like, well, are you into like being entertained, you know, yeah. or like having fun, or more importantly, just if you, there's no writer better at King that will take you out of your world and plant you into another world. I said that last time.
Yeah.
And everyone, I don't care who you are, you know, everyone, male, female, parent, single person, you know, black, white, red, purple, will have pockets in their life where they just want to not think about their problems anymore.
Yeah.
And if you're a reader, Stephen King is a great companion for that reason alone. Like, leave your brain at the door if you want. I don't think you always need to, but leave your brain at the door if you want. And Stephen King will suck you in. He's a very expert storyteller, and you will have kind of a tense or a good time, but you're not going to be thinking about your problems. You're going to be immersed in Stephen King's world. So that's number one.
Mm-hmm.
And then a deeper one would be, and Stephen King has talked about this himself. Like I said, I'm not coming up with all this by myself, but I profoundly agree with it. You know, at least in terms of Stephen King's horror works or violent works or bloody works, like Stephen King has talked about how, you know, what separates us from the animals. And one of us is the fact that we are the only species out there that we know of definitively who have like rites of passage. I mean, you can argue that there are rites of passage in the animal kingdom, but not for like psychological or like, you know, grappling with the meaning of the world and where we fit into it kind of reasons. We don't know if animals do that or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe some of them do. Mm-hmm. But there's one rite of passage, King points this out, that human beings are capable of confronting, but they can't. It's the only rite of passage that you can't say, I'm going through this rite of passage, like for graduating from high school and going into college, or leaving the single world and getting married, and you can discuss them with other human beings and work through them. There's only one rite of passage that you can't do that with, and that's death.
Right.
So horror fiction, scary fiction, violent fiction, it offers you a way, just in short, to confront that rite of passage that nobody can tell you about, that you have no other resource to confront it with. But horror writers or violent writers or scary stories or stuff like that give us a way to just kind of confront that rite of passage, you know? So maybe that would appeal to a certain type of reader who hadn't looked at Stephen King that way, you know?
Yeah, that's a good answer, man. Impressive.
Well, I got some of it I got from Stephen King himself, but like when I heard him speaking about it that way, I very much agreed with it, and it made sense to me that it would be a good reason, good line of reason as to why humanity in general enjoys like dark or scary stories.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, you know, and then as far as where to start a person, I mean, I guess I would have to say, John, I would start a person early in Steve's.
Well, let me cut you off for a second. And that's to say that, like, I want to add to it a little bit. Can you hear me?
Yeah. You mean add to what I just said?
No. I just want to, another caveat would be like, if somebody says that you convince them that, to read something by King, and maybe they're a little bit averse, like they don't want a lot of blood and guts. So okay. like my wife would be in that category. She doesn't want a lot of gore and bloody. So that's another, like, is there kind of a quote unquote, I'm very much air quotes, like a sort of a safer place to introduce people to King, but also emphasize some of his skills as a storyteller?
Well, that's a good one.
And I know, you know, you didn't have any prep for this, so it's not easy.
Yeah. I mean, you have to take out a lot of his early work.
Right.
If he didn't, you know, I might say a book, and this is funny because I hate to say this, John, I managed to avoid saying this, but I've never read the book Misery. I have it, and I haven't read it yet. I've seen the movie. But that might be a good choice because it does have violence in it, yes. But I think as far as I know, it's fairly minimal, and more of it is like psychological warfare, and the, like, King has a way of addressing like the really great big fears, like being trapped somewhere with no escape, or the dark, or like, you know, like a
right.
And this, you know, is a story that like imagines his particular or a successful writer's particular ultimate nightmare. And, you know, he gets his writer in that story into that house with the insane fan. Now, how's he going to get him out, or what's going to happen?
Right.
And that is a, and it's not, I didn't read the book. I know there's more violence in the book, bloody violence in the book, but I think it's more about the war, like the psych ops between, you know, this writer and this insane fan. And you just, you're like, how is he going to escape this situation? You know? And I think that would be a good kind of place to start. If you're a fantasy person, you might start with something like The Dark Tower or something like that. But there's a lot of violence in those books too.
Yeah.
I mean, let me throw it to you. Like, what, like for somebody like your wife or somebody who doesn't want all the blood and violence, because you take out almost the entire first 15 years. You know,
right.
Like,
right.
You know, I mean, yeah. Maybe something like Lisi's story, John, from 2006, because it does have violence in it, but it's much more about the marriage of this writer and the widow he leaves behind, and kind of the nature of the writer's inaccessibility to other people because they live in their own imaginative world. Now, Lisi's story is one of my least favorite King books. You may be asking about that down the road, but
yeah,
that's
another thing. We're going to get to that. Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, what would you say?
Well, yeah, I mean, I had a little more chance to think about it than you, and that's true of all these questions, but I think you did fine and had a intelligent answer. And it's funny because this is, you know, the twin mind again, because Misery was one of the four ideas that I had to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
And for some of the same reasons, it's like it does have some violent parts in it, but it's more psychological. And I think Misery is one of my favorite books by Stephen King. We'll get to that too, you know, mm-hmm. But because it just seems so plausible. It's just a fascinating exercise for a successful, really successful writer like him to kind of turn the tables on himself and put himself in a way in the middle of the horror. Like, because the character is a successful novelist, as you said, who gets sort of trapped and kidnapped by a rabid fan, basically.
Right.
And how that plays out. And it's mostly psychological. But it's a, talk about a page turner. I mean, this guy's in a really bad situation with a really crazy person. And you're like, and he can't move. And you're like, how is he going to get out of this? So it's just a...
Right.
That's a great setup for a story, you know, like it's a thriller.
And at the time it was like, you know, I remember when it came out, John, you and I were like at the beginning of high school, beginning of college. And, you know, the universal thing was like, before anybody could even read that, they were like, oh man, there's only one person in the world who could write this story.
Right.
You know, and it was King, you know, like.
and it has a whole very interesting meta element to it too, because there's, she's such a fan that they have this ongoing argument about the way the writer is treating the main character who's named Misery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a really interesting, it's one of his best books in my opinion, but
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was one, a second one. And this is the part of the show from here on out where we're just riffing on different ideas we have about King. So like, you know, I would throw out to you, like maybe The Green Mile, just cause it was, you know, it has that capital punishment element to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not super violent, but there's more of a compassion in that story than you see in other King stories because it's about this prisoner, and also it was serialized. So I didn't love it, but I could see somebody starring with that who didn't want the bloody and, you know, gory King.
Yeah. Except for there's one really horrible, capital punishment, my electric chair.
Right.
In that story.
Right.
You know,
well, I mean, that's kind of an element in the story. So, yeah, that wouldn't be fun. You're right. Another choice I had was...
But it's a good choice. Pardon me. It's a good choice.
Yeah. Different Seasons was another one. Because that's that four novellas. And at least three of them are not really gory and scary. You know, they're just kind of... you know, the body is more of a, what Stand By Me was based on is kind of coming of age, really.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I haven't read it, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but then you have the story that was the basis for the Shawshank Redemption.
Right.
You also have, what else do you have?
I can supply the other two because I just bought this book. I found it very cheap.
One is called The Breathing Method, which is about, that one sounds like it's kind of horrible.
Yeah, that's been described from time to time as having one of the worst childbirth scenes in it. So,
okay.
I want to stay away from that. And the other one is Apt Pupil.
Apt Pupil, which is, right.
Yeah.
Which is also, from what I understand, all three of those, besides The Breathing Method, were made into films. And I think Apt Pupil is this kid who, kind of like Fairy Tale, actually, who forms this relationship with this old neighbor, only to find out that he was once a member of the Nazi party, I think.
Yeah, he's like a,
so, interesting,
evil Nazi, you know?
Yeah, kind of an interesting connection to the Green Mile in it. I mean, to Fairy Tale in it.
Yeah.
And then the last one I thought of, and I have definitely not read this, and I'm only going by the description, but I can't remember if you have or not, but it would be a more recent book called The Colorado Kid.
Mm.
Just because from the way that's described, it's sort of like Stephen King's version of like a Dashiell Hammett story.
Okay.
And I don't know, that just could be like, if nothing else, that might give you a totally different impression of who King is, the kind of writer that he is, but that's just speculation.
Yeah. Maybe something like, there's a short novel called The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon.
Hmm.
About a girl who gets lost on a hike and has to try to find her way back. And she does it by, like, you know, imagining, you know, sort of scenarios. And I think there's a dark quality to it. I haven't actually read it, but, you know, she has this, like, imaginary relationship with her favorite baseball player, who was an actual baseball player named Tom Gordon on the Red Sox.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Didn't know that.
So, you know, I mean, could anyway, be something like that.
These questions are designed to be sort of like thought exercises around Stephen King. That's all they're going to be.
Yes.
Just riffs. So
no, it's cool. It's cool. Yeah. Yeah. I like your choices. Colorado Kid is a good one. It's like and then he has another noir title called Later.
Yeah. Colorado Kid, I didn't know much about, but I was reading the description. It's like, it's like a couple policemen sitting around and somebody brings up the story of the Colorado Kid and it's like an unsolved murder case. And I thought, well, that sounds kind of fun. Anyway, so that was that one. But I got another question for you. All right. You ready?
Hey, yeah.
This is just now the rest of these questions go more into your own, you know, Jude Lovell, his personal experience reading King. Okay.
Yeah, I hope everybody doesn't, like, hang up the phone, you know, or whatever.
Well, anybody who's a fan of King, I think, will or are interested in King will enjoy this part. So, and it's just a basic question, Jude, and we've talked about it before, I think outside of this particular recording right now, but we've talked about the works of King that we've both read. What are some of the King works that you have yet to read that you really want to?
Well, I bought two of them today.
I just passed to you. You're under the basket. There's nobody there. It's a simple layup. Don't do what you did in like ninth grade.
Nobody will understand that, but let's just say I got in a situation like that on a basketball court, and it did not go well.
It did not end well, no.
Well, I've always sucked as an athlete. So, strangely, my favorite decade in popular culture is not the 1990s.
Agreed.
Never has been. You know, maybe because we were finished with our teams, I don't know. I'm not that into 90s music. I'm not that into 90s movies. You know, I'm not that into 90s politics or Clinton or whatever. But King in the 90s, though, there's a lot of gaps in there that I have been interested in reading for a long time. So today I found two of them cheap. We talked about them in the Well, not one of them, but we talked about the other one. There's a really huge book that I got today. Today, I'm proud of myself. I bought set like 1,700 word pages of Stephen King, more additional to read for like $12. So that's fun.
Nice.
But there's three big books from the 90s that I really want to read. Now I own all three. I haven't read any one of them. The first one is Bag of Bones, which I have here at home. From 1998. The second one is called Insomnia. And I think it was like 94 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
And just because I, you know, that's a real blind spot. I have absolutely no idea what that book is really about. But I've heard it mentioned here and there. And then the last one is Under the Dome, which wasn't from the 90s. Sorry. I think that was from the early 2000s. We talked about it last time. Just that crazy. And here it is again with King and just his ideas. He could do whatever he wants. Okay, imagine like a force field descends over a town and the people inside the force field are kind of cut off, and what would happen, you know?
Yeah.
And to me, that bears resemblance to another Stephen King book from the 90s that I really wanted to catch up with, but I did this year finally. That's called Needful Things. That came out right at the beginning of the 90s. It's kind of a similar setup in a way. I mean, it was subtitled The Last Castle Rock Story. I don't think it was The Last Castle Rock Story. But in this fictional town of Castle Rock, this guy moves in, this mysterious figure moves in, ends up being basically the devil, Mephistopheles or something. He opens up a little antique shop where you can walk in and he'll have like waiting there for you, like the thing you desire the most sitting there on the shelf, you know, like for one kid, it's an old comic book or like a baseball card or something like that. And for some of the middle-aged women, it's like a Tiffany lamp or something that they've been obsessed with for years. And the owner's like, you can have this for sure. They're like, what's the price? He's like, it's free, but you got to do me a little favor. And he kind of pits all the people of the town against each other and just all hell breaks loose, quite literally.
Again, it's such a brilliant premise.
Yeah, that's the book, the Stephen King book that begins with a single sentence on a blank white page that says, you've been here before. And then you flip the page.
Oh, that's so great.
And it says, I know you have. I never forget a face. Like the first lines on the second page. You know, like, anyway, but like, so Under the Dome, Insomnia, and Bag of Bones are like big, thick horror novels that he wrote in the 90s. I just don't really have a sense of how horrible his horror books from the 90s are. I also didn't read books like Gerald's Game. I have it. I've never read it. Rose Matter, Dolores Claiborne, books like that. Mm-hmm. So I have a real blind spot around the 90s. And then, gosh, I know I've got other answers to this.
Well, you've already given some really good ones.
Well, there's one more, and this is strange. I don't think this is considered one of King's like best books. Well, I'll give two more because there's one really early classic one that I've never read. We talked about last time. It's called Firestarter. I'd like to read that because I haven't read it.
No, we didn't. We didn't talk about it. We talked about it outside of the episode. But that's a good one. Neither one of us have come near to that one.
No. And then one more, John. Then I'd love to hear yours. There's an obscure book from the later 2010s. I just don't really know anything about this book or what led to it, except for the fact that King, you know, at some point he achieved such wealth that he became one of these people who like divides their time, you know, meaning they have like two or three houses, and King spends part of his life in Florida because he owns property in Florida. And Duma Key is the name of the novel. It's kind of a big novel and it's set entirely in Florida. But I have no idea what that book is really about. So it's just kind of a blind spot. So I'd say Duma Key also.
Oh, wow. I thought you had read that one for some reason.
No, I have no. I don't even know what that book is about. I think there's a painting in it. That's about all I know.
Well, that's interesting because there's another book kind of around that time that's called Finders Keepers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. That's part of a trilogy.
I don't know anything about that one. But anyway. I didn't really answer this one because the reason I didn't was because I...
Oh, I have another one. I'm going to add it later. Go ahead.
Okay. you can do it in a minute because I gave the list of what I had read and we talked a little bit about some of my blind spots, which are some of the more major works. There's a couple in there that you mentioned, like in both Insomnia and Bag of Bones, that I don't know anything about those two. I don't know what they're about. Well, the one thing I read somewhere about Insomnia, I mean, Insomnia is about a guy who can't sleep, you know, and then, you know, I think he like his insomnia gets so bad, he actually develops these like weird powers. But the one thing I did hear about that book is that it like deliberately references a lot of his older books, which I think that would be a lot of fun for you.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So there's that. I don't know a damn thing about Bag of Bones. I have no idea. There's another book in there that I looked at today that's called From a Buick 8. And I don't have no idea what that's about either. So like, but I've got a ton of blind spots. So like you never read From a Buick 8, did you?
No, but I know two distinctions about it. One is that it has a similar plot to Christine, which is kind of weird. And number two is that that's the first comeback horror novel he wrote after he was hit by that van. The first book he wrote was called From a Buick 8.
Well, that's so weird that he wrote about a vehicle.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, what was the other one you were going to bring up? And then we'll move on to my next question.
Yeah, really quick. It's called Revival.
Oh, yeah.
It's from like the 2010, somewhere in there. And I don't know much about that book either. I think it has like a rock star in it, maybe, or, you know. But I did hear on a podcast, somebody described that as his personal, just some random guy, but his personal candidate for the most terrifying ending of a Stephen King book was Revival. So,
wow.
But I don't know anything about it, so.
Oh, there's one more I want to mention in here too. This is not I'm not recommending this and I haven't read it, but one of the best worst movies that I have ever watched is the movie version of Dreamcatcher. Have you ever seen that?
No, I would watch it immediately based on that alone.
Oh, yeah. And it makes me want to read. It's such a dumb story. And it's set in Derry, Maine, like a lot of his books. So it's like, you know, a group of kids, something bad happens, and like they all end up there as adults later. I mean, it's like, stop me if you've heard this before, you know, like, but all I remember is there's literally like a monster made out of human excrement at one point. It is one of the weirdest and worst movies you will ever watch.
Look that up right now.
I had a friend of mine who told me you have to see Dreamcatcher, and not in a good way. And of course, that was like catnip to me. But like the movie's so bad, I can't even imagine what the novel's like. So that might be like just a lot of fun for you to read someday too.
I mean, there's so many examples of just the stupidest thing in the world that Stephen King put in a book. You know, like you can't imagine, like it has a scene where there's this kid with asthma.
I'm laughing already. I don't even know what to say.
I'm going to curse again, but it's so stupid. It's hilarious. You know, they're fighting the monster under the sewers and it when they're kids, you know, this is part of the way through the book or whatever. And the kid, and then somebody says like, you know, take out something that means something to you. You can fight it with that, you know? And I can't even get it out. The kid has asthma. He's this like spindly kid with asthma. And he pulls out, I'll never forget this line from the book. I remember it. Of course, King put it in all caps in case you missed the emphasis. Kid takes his inhaler out and sprays the inhaler in it had taken the form of a spider, like a giant spider. Sprays the inhaler spray or whatever in the face of the giant spider. And he goes, "This is battery acid, fuck nuts." And that's the kind of thing. Fuck nuts. I mean, come on, man. And that's the dumbest thing in the world. Or you know, at the end of, this is spoiler city, at the end of The Dark Half, which is kind of a scary book. about a writer and his alter ego. But it goes like so many King stories go way off the rails at the end. And at the end of that book, the bad guy, the sort of evil doppelganger, is like literally disintegrating. And these like sparrows that had been like, you know, floating around the whole book for no reason, like just come and attack him in the end. And they lift him into the sky and just like rip him apart little piece by piece in the sky. And
you're like, what?
That makes no sense. And then there's stuff in, you know, there's stuff in so many King books that are like that. And you're like, you know, that's just absurd.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. He really does not, again, he does not have much of a filter. So pretty much anything goes.
Yeah. It's that line from the U2 song that Bono sings about losing his mother. Nobody tells me no, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what it's like with Stephen King, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. All right. So this is going to be a tough one because he's got such a vast body of work, but if you don't have an immediate answer, or you can't think of one, we can move on. But, and also because so much has already been done, but is there any book or work of his that you can think of that has not been adapted into like a TV series or a movie that you would love to see? It's tough because a lot of it has.
Yeah. A lot of it really has.
And this question is like something may jump to mind or it may not, you know?
Well, I was going to say like kind of a literal version of the Dark Tower, that entire saga, it would be nearly impossible.
Oh, that's a good answer. Yeah.
But that would really, they tried it and they just screwed it up six ways from Sunday.
Did you ever see that?
No, I can't. I know it's bad. They try to condense it into kind of a 2.5-hour movie and it can't be done. But there's some stuff in that series that's so insane that I guess that would be my answer. Just if there was some way to like do the entire thing in a literal sense, it would go on forever, but it would be really interesting. There's some really weird, there's tons of super dumb stuff in there, but there are some really wild sequences. Like the whole first novel is basically a Western, and the whole second half of the first novel is this one man just kind of shooting up everything in an entire village, you know, like, so there could be kind of a, interesting, you know, cinematic filming of that. One of the novels has this giant raid on like an oil facility with this like massive, you know, conflagration of fire and destruction. That would be interesting to watch. You know, another one has this huge shootout in a post office. Another one has, you know, this people from the other world invading Stephen King's actual house and talking to Stephen King. You know, while he's writing Salem's Lot in the 70s.
Wow.
You know, just kind of that, I guess that would be my answer. That would be really kind of wild to see.
No, that's a great answer. Like I was actually thinking the only thing I could really think of to answer my own question would be The Long Walk.
Like, oh yeah, that would be really cool.
And I mean, again, we talked about the book was kind of long, but you know, there might be an interesting way to do it in the right hands.
Yeah, I'm sure there are others, but so, that's what comes to mind.
We're getting to the end here. I have kind of a speed round of just a bunch, kind of a three or four questions in a row that are just kind of, I'm just sort of looking for quick opinions from you. All right?
Okay.
So we can do these kind of quickly, and it'll be sort of fun. And I can ring in as well, but coming from someone who's read a lot more than me, most underappreciated Stephen King book that you can think of?
Night Shift.
Ooh.
I mean, I think a lot of people like it, and I think a lot of people have read it, but that is one of the funnest horror books for me, and it's in direct proportion to how dang stupid it is, like we were just talking about. But it's, for me, it's like the quintessential young King, when, and I've said this a lot of ways, I wrote about this in my book about Herman Melville, believe it or not, but that is the time for me, like the early 70s, that I don't know if it's my favorite period of all King, maybe it is, but it's like when he was so hungry to sell you any concept that he could sell you, you know, mm-hmm. that he, you know, would just works so hard at selling these ridiculous tales. That's the one that has Graveyard Shift with the giant rats under the cotton mill or whatever it was that eat people. You know, that's the one that has this like story about an alien force that comes down and like invades this one man's body, and he's got and these eyeballs appear in his the palm of his hand. You know that because it's an alien invasion. It's like invading. That's a really scary kind of sinister story. That has the original short story called Jerusalem's Lot that turned into – that was like kind of a precursor to Salem's Lot, and it was a very like – very effective, short, kind of like a – almost an Edgar Allan Poe or old-timey horror story. There are other stories in it. The one with the little green army men killing people is in there. The famous kind of like, you know, reincarnation or don't speak ill of the dead because they might back and kill you. They may come back and kill you because sometimes they come back is in there.
Yep.
But I just, you could just feel his like hunger to like lure you into the craziest and most sinister and lots of violence concept possible. So that's probably my answer to that one.
That's a great answer. And also, it kind of, you know, you remember like the 50s and 60s, they used to have these like comic books or other anthologies, like Weird Tales.
Mm-hmm.
That's like his version of that.
Yes. Yes. Perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I love that.
Twilight Zone.
Yeah. Like just like some of the weirdest shit you can imagine.
Yeah. Leave your brain at the door and you will have for best results. You will have the most fun possible reading Night Shift.
That's a, you know, I love that answer. That's a great answer. You were ready for that one.
Good one. Yeah, thanks. What's yours? Like, what would you say? Do you have one?
I didn't. I kind of put these at you.
The teacher called on you, John.
Well, you've read a lot more than me, so I thought that would. But, I mean, you mentioned The Dark Half, and I always thought that's one of the, we talked about Warmer versus Nastier King. Definitely one of the nastier ones.
Yeah, but yeah. What about Pet Sematary? Sorry.
Well, if you're still... we're going to get to that. So you're
okay.
You're,
all right.
For me, it's like I've always remembered it because it's a common, you know, the doppelganger or like the two sides to a writer. Like you know, like there's like the writer me, and then there's like the writer king, and there's like the family man king, you know. That's a common theme to kind of explore two people in the same body. But I always thought The Dark Half was kind of an effective. And it's been noted, too, that like that's the last book he wrote when he was still struggling with his addictions. And I feel like you can really feel that he's wrestling with himself. Like, here's me as a writer of nasty fiction, and here's me as like a family guy.
Yeah.
I just think that's an interesting, and plus there's a literal like sort of like twin theme to it that's interesting to us. So that's one I've always kind of appreciated. It was made into a movie, which is okay. But another one might be On Writing, you know, because like I feel like
I thought about that. Yeah.
That had its moment, but you know, I'm not even a King aficionado by any stretch, and I don't write novels, but I love that book. I thought that book was really entertaining. So it's just a couple ideas.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Well, so here's another one along those lines, and you tipped your hand a little bit, but give me a Stephen King book that you really dislike.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Lisey's Story is one of my least favorite Stephen King books.
Lisey's Story is one of my Lisey favorite.
Did I say that?
No, but you should have. Yeah.
It's one of my Lisey favorite stories. I'll give you that and maybe one other book and then kind of a broad comment about Stephen King stuff that I don't like.
Well, okay, you can do that, but I want to for a minute or two plumb into, because I've heard you say this before, you know, just in conversation. What is it about, why do you dislike Lisey's Story as much as you do?
It was a book. Well, you know, somewhere along the way, I heard that he thought it was like his most poignant or his favorite story, and he still says that, by the way. So that might have affected my take on it. It was an attempt to, like sort of entwine together, I guess. Almost a romantic story about a marriage, you know, mm-hmm. a love story between two people who have been married a long time and have been through a lot together and kind of have battled to maintain their marriage through thick and thin. And then horror elements. And also it involved this like imaginary world. So it was like Lisi's story is about a famous writer, very much like King, but like kind of more embraced by the critical world. More on that later. That's where things started to go wrong for me right there. Mm-hmm. You know, it was almost like a King, the version of King that he wished that he was in the eyes of like literary critics. Mm-hmm. And I think he went through a whole period where he was like really interested in kind of boosting his reputation among the critical literary establishment, which I think was a big mistake. But then the writer dies and the story's about Lisi, the widow, and she has to kind of like deal with the fallout of this writer and his fans and all that kind of stuff. But where it kind of goes awry, this is very Stephen King, but he imagines this other world that Scott, the writer Scott in the book, inhabited, which is sort of metaphorically a stand-in for a place like kind of a writer goes to do their work. Or to come up with their ideas. And of course, this being a Stephen King fantastical book where anything goes, the wife finds a way to basically brook passage into this other place. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the story takes place in this other place. I thought, first of all, the other place was called Booyah Moon, which I thought was ridiculous. And I just couldn't get over that name. It was like Boo, the word Boo, apostrophe, Yah, Y-A-H, Moon. I thought that was stupid, and I still can't get over it. So that was one problem. And then the more the book went on, she spent more time in this other world, and I could feel King straining to add elements that people expect from Stephen King, like blood, violence, horror, into this story about a marriage. And I thought that combination just did not work. Mm. You know? I didn't really buy the marriage story, and I definitely didn't buy the horror story. And I remember finishing it, and I thought that book just was bad. I did not like that book at all. So, and then there's one other book I'll mention. It's called Just Past Sunset. It's a collection of short stories. I can think of a few different stories that I could criticize from Stephen King. I just could not even finish them for the same reason, because I thought they were too long and too bloated and too full of exposition. I didn't like much of that book at all. I thought there were real attempts to write like kind of weightier horror stories that did not work. They weren't scary. They weren't very weighty. You know, weighty meaning like somehow of a better literary quality. But there was one story in there where a woman got abducted. Great premise. She got like abducted by this crazy man on a beach in an isolated place. And he tied her into this chair in the kitchen. And John, this was a short story. That story went on for so long describing how she was unraveling herself from this chair. It was like 30 pages of her explaining how she got her hand out of the ropes.
Wow.
I thought, man, I can't. I literally couldn't finish it. I was like, I can't. I don't care anymore. You know, get her out of the freaking chair. Yeah. You know? Yeah. So I did not like that book. I thought, again, this was him. He was chosen to edit the Best American Short Fiction volume. This came up the last time. And so to prepare for that, he read tons of like literary fiction stories. And then immediately after that, he went to write his own collection where he aspired towards that. I just don't think it works. I think he was just trying to be something he's not. Huh. And then I'll just add as the last guy, I think King, there was a period there where he started writing about writers, but like writers that had like won the National Book Award or were famous for, you know, one novel that was like, you know, the Pulitzer Prize winner and stuff. And when he started writing about writers that were kind of him, but like more accepted by the critics, number one, it just felt like sour grapes. And number two, it wasn't plausible. So you mentioned a book before called Finders Keepers. That's the middle installment of the what's called the End of Watch trilogy. which starts with Mr. Mercedes and ends with End of Watch. But the second one, Finders Keepers, is all about this famous novelist who, like, won the National Book Award and stuff. I haven't read the book, but I wouldn't read it because by then I was like, nah. When he writes about writers that he kind of wishes he were more like, seems to me, it just whiffs of, I don't know, it like just, it's not, it's inauthentic. It's not Stephen King. Stephen King's better when he's just ripping a yarn around the fire.
Yep. Like we've said a number of times. Yeah. That's another good answer. Yeah. I knew you'd have an answer for that one.
Yeah. Anyway, do you have any, like, was there one you read that you just thought was just bottom of the barrel?
Kind of looking at the list of that I wrote down of books that I have read. Most of them I think are pretty good, but I just think a lot of them are too long. Desperation is one that just seemed, it was like very long and it seemed mostly silly to me.
Yeah, yeah. The Regulators by Richard Bachman is a bad Stephen King book.
Yeah, okay.
Sure.
And Cell is bad. Again, great premise. I actually love the premise because it was, you know, like cell phones weren't that, were still relatively new, and the idea that, like, although new, but like everybody had one, and like the idea that some kind of, like, you know, virus or something that can make everybody a zombie that goes to everybody at the same time through their cell phone, I thought was kind of a clever conceit. You know, you probably remember, I still remember looking in like a brick and mortar Barnes and Noble and picking that hardcover up, and it, you know, you look at the about the author on the back and it says, oh, Stephen King is the author of blah, 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 blah. And then the last line was, he does not own a cell phone. You know, I thought, well, that's kind of funny. Clever idea. But then the book, then, you know, then there's like 400 more pages. And it, you know, it just gets really stupid. So I didn't think that was a great book. But anyway, I haven't, there's so much I haven't read of King that I'm not the best person to answer that question. But here's another one that's like it. All right. Pinning your back to the wall. What's the scariest Stephen King book that you've read?
Oh boy.
And I mean, we talked way back, you know, in the first handful of episodes about scary books.
Right.
We talked about how hard it is to actually be frightened or unnerved.
Yes.
And this is, I'll just say, coming out, like I said it the last time in part one, and it came up again tonight. For me, the answer is definitely Pet Sematary. And I have my reasons for that. But, you know, do you have an immediate answer? Is it the same answer, or is it you're just not sure, or none of them are scary?
Well, I think it's very hard to actually scare by reading. I mean, that list for me is like, I could count on one hand, and I'm talking about anybody, not just King.
Yep.
But yeah, I can come up, I think for me, at least the ones I've read, I can come up with one book and then one chapter.
Okay.
And I would say is one of the scariest chapters I ever read.
Love it.
So the scariest book probably for me is The Shining. And you know, the reason is because, well, it's a lot more sinister and disturbing book than the movie, which is pretty disturbing.
Yeah.
But like the, it was one of King's earlier novels. He was still very hungry. Like I said, it's the, and you and I have talked about this a lot. First of all, like the weapon at the end with Jack Torrance, spoiler alert, in the novel, The Shining, to me is scarier because it's not an axe like it is in the movie. It's this huge, like, wood mallet, like a big honking wooden mallet that he's chasing his family around. And he really messes up Wendy Torrance with that mallet, which I thought was very frightening and kind of vicious, you know. Not to mention another big spoiler, but he offs himself with the mallet in the book and he really hammers the crap out of his skull. And King describes it, you know, close range.
Oh, I didn't actually know that. Wow.
Yeah, it's scary. But also because the way that book builds tension, So you have the slow unraveling of Jack Torrance's sanity in that snowbound place, and it really does a good job of doing it slowly, you know. And then on top of that, there's the real life layer of King himself being so enslaved by alcohol and demons and raising little kids at the time, that I just find as a kind of a background notion to, as somebody who writes and, you know, occasionally tries to exercise something that happened to him. Like, I can think of a couple stories I've written where I was trying to work through something bad that happened to me. And that to me adds a level of kind of terror to that book too. And then real quick, one of the scariest chapters I've ever read. And you know, you need to read this book for many reasons. But for this one too, you know where I'm going with this?
No.
Is the opening chapter of the book, The Stand, is a high point of terror in Stephen King's body of work to me.
Oh,
it's like the beginning of that tale is like the sort of the way that it like follows the way that this super flu escapes from the army lab and goes out into the world, you know. And the way the chapter, it's just terrifying. The way the chapter ends is this one guy escapes and he gets somewhere, and then you realize you're hoping he doesn't have it. And then he starts like getting a snuffly nose and stuff. And then you realize at the end of the chapter that he dies in like a horrible way. And then you realize it's just out, you know, and you're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's a great chapter. That's maybe one of my favorite Stephen King, like, chapters, is the opening chapter of The Stand, you know?
Yeah, I actually have read it then, because I mentioned to you off air that I actually, point in my life, read like the first 200 pages of The Stand.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So yeah. I kind of vaguely remember that, but I don't consider myself having read it, because there's so much of it I didn't get to, but, I can distill it down even further from a chapter. I can tell you maybe the most frightening moment of any, from any King book. And I remember this, you know, kind of vaguely, but, it's the point. You revealed you've never read Pet Sematary or no Misery.
So, yeah. No, I've read Pet Sematary. But,
you know, the first time he buries the cat, and spoiler alert, he buries the cat in the cemetery behind his house or back in the woods. And then he's just working in his garage. And King describes very slowly this, like the black cat walking around the corner and and coming back into the garage. That to me, like as a late teenager, I was totally freaked out by that.
Yeah.
It's very simple, but just that whole premise, you know, is very frightening. Like you bury your pets back there, they come back. And so then of course something happens to the guy's young son. So what's he going to do? You know? And it's just, that's a really eerie idea that there's some creepy cemetery behind your house.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Yeah. So
there's two other super scary King moments I could mention really quick.
Go ahead.
I thought so. The original scene in the very beginning of it where Georgie's boat floats into the sewer, the way Stephen King describes that clown coming out of the sewer and killing that boy in that opening part of it is really effective. It's done through all the senses. You know, I remember distinctly, like, you know, Georgie puts his little head into the sewer and Stephen King writes it really effectively in like this little 5-year-old boy's voice like literary voice. He sticks his head in and he's like, you know, he thought he could smell cotton candy. And then he uses like exclamation points and he goes like, and peanuts, there's peanuts. He could smell peanuts, you know? And you're like, oh shit. You know, cause there ain't no carnival down there. And then there's a line where it doesn't sound scary, but just the way King builds up to it. And then he says, like, he's talking to the clown. And then there's a line that just says and then the clown's face changed, and changed is in italics. And for some reason, it doesn't sound scary, but you're like, like, you know. And then similarly, there's a Stephen King short story that I think is very scary. It's from a book I didn't totally like. It's called Nightmares and Dreamscapes because it's a bloated story collection with very much hit and miss. But the first story in that book is called Suffer the Little Children. Mm-hmm. And it would be even darker now. You could never get away with it now, but it's about this substitute teacher who goes in and basically she's just teaching these little kids. And when she turns her back to write on the backboard, she hears like these creepy noises and stuff. And then she'll turn around and one of the kid will have like this totally like morphed demonic face. And it start for no reason. And then she'll turn back, start writing on the board again. She'll turn around and it'll be like another kid. And then the woman, like basically in the space of, you know, the short story, she just kind of loses her mind. Forget exactly how she does it, but she takes all the kids into the mimeograph room, like where they make the dittos.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she slaughters them all.
Oh, boy.
You know, and then the cops come in and they see this woman who's just slaughtered a first grade classroom, you know. Boy.
Wow.
But it's a scary story. You can't, you know, it's too prescient for now with school shootings and stuff, but it's a very scary story, though.
Wow. I'm not sure I've heard you talk about that one. That's freaked out.
And that title is great, too. You know, like.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, not in real life, of course, but.
So I have two more questions, but we're getting close to the end here. I don't want to. So I'm going to ask you to answer one really quickly, and then the second one is harder, but maybe you could just give me a knee-jerk reaction to the second one, okay?
Okay.
So the first one is, I was going to ask you, and we were going to talk a little bit more about this, but we don't really need to, but if there's, so you know what I've read from King, and we've touched on a lot of the ones I haven't read. What, if you... You know, again, back to the wall. You know, your poor old co-host here only has 3 months more to live on this planet. What is the one King book I have to read? I said this in part one before I kick it.
Oh, geez.
It's tough because of the circumstances I just set up, but like, what's one that it's like, man, you got to read this before you're off the King train. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I think I got two.
Okay.
One, and I'm sorry because they're both huge, but sorry about that. You better start reading if you only have 3 months.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, but one we were just talking about is The Stand.
Yeah.
You know, and the other one is It. They're not my favorite King books, but It in particular, you know, is kind of a magnum opus for King in terms of it's got many dumb moments and it's got that like controversial thing I spoke of, but it's a classic King book. The concept of an entire town being haunted is really fascinating. And he goes, and it's not a flawless book at all. Like the explanation of where all this comes from is kind of ridiculous, but it's the book where King really tried to, you know, create a whole, I don't know what the word I want is. It's like not universe, but like
mythology.
Yeah. Thank you. And the level of effort he made to do that in that town and It is very impressive. And there are some long set pieces in there that, if nothing else, involved tons of research, tons of imagination, you know, like, and he ties it all back to this thing that ended up taking the form of a clown. It's a classic King book, and it's like really kind of goes a long way to like the power of his imagination. It's like kind of his like really kind of, if not masterwork, just masterwork of like, you know, masterpiece of you know, letting it all fly is It. So I'd say those two.
Well, that's interesting. One of them, like The Stand, would have been on my list, and It would not have been. But now you're kind of selling me on It a little bit, like because it just, I think I've been somewhat colored by the two recent films that I think were every bit as bloated as any King book, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if you would really like it, but for some reason, I think it really is kind of like a really quintessential, you know, it's just so expansive and so like, you know, it really must have been like a Titanic book to try to write.
Well, and now I issue my own language warning here, but you and I probably, you mentioned we listen to the same podcast, and in one of them he goes, and this ties it all together because it's like, this is so King. He's like, just Mr. Colloquial. He's like your next door neighbor. And he goes, you know what? Like, you know where I'm going with this too. He goes, he literally says it this way. He goes, you know what? When I leave this earth, people aren't going to remember people aren't going to remember everything that I've done, but they're going to remember that fucking clown.
That's so true. You know,
but he's like, you know, there's something to be said for that.
Yeah. And some of Pennywise as a character is a really kind of delicious Stephen King character. Stupid, you know, but man, does he fuck with those kids?
Yeah, and he's,
you know,
it's kind of, and he's sort of indelible.
You know? He hits them all where they live, you know?
Yeah. So that's,
you know,
anyway, we can wrap this up. I was going to say the other one, I was going to literally again for the third time, but this is like, you know, actually pinning the tail to the donkey. Like your third time's a charm. I was going to say, what's your favorite King book? You have to name one. That's what I thought. Dead silence.
Yeah. I mean, it might be Night Shift. It might be Night Shift, which is so funny because it's people would read it and be like, man, that's the dumbest book I ever read. But, and it kind of is, but it's just fun. Like, it's like a scary book that's fun, you know?
Well,
and
I
it's
agree.
Just stupid, you know, like, you can't, you almost can't. I just remember reading that book. I really want to reread it. I only read it once and being like, I just can't believe that he wrote stories like this, you know, that it made him into this huge thing. I mean, these are insane, you know?
Yeah, but you mentioned, you know, it's like with any artist, like your favorite singer, it's always the early albums that you go back to and you're like,
that's right.
You know, because like, you know, like our brother, our older brother, Springsteen with The Wild and the Innocent, the East Street Shuffle.
Yeah, like, right.
You know, when Bruce is still young and hungry. And it's the same thing here with this book. It's like King is young and you can tell he's hungry and he's just riffing on his favorite kinds of tales. And
yeah,
it's just fun. Like you said, it's fun.
Yeah, it seems like he really wanted it, you know.
And, you know, if there's one word that we can end this whole thing on, it should be fun.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So there you go, folks. Our two-part Magnum epic episode on Stephen King. That brings us to the end. Of course, we could do many more. I mean, dude, we could have a whole episode on the Dark Tower series alone, except we're never gonna, because I'm never gonna read that sucker.
Yeah, you wouldn't. Yeah, I don't think you should. You know, they're really kind of silly books, but they're like, I like them. I'm glad I read them, but they're pretty silly.
Yeah, that probably isn't gonna happen, folks. But what is gonna happen is episode 62. And so as we leave you tonight, Jude, can you tell us a little bit about what we're planning? Tell our listeners what we're planning for episode 62.
Yeah, sure. So this one's my baby, so I might as well fall on the sword here.
There you go.
But every once in a while, we do an episode that we like to call, a series we like to call the BXC Reviews. And we haven't done it in a little while, but that's where we drill down really heavily into just one book. Now, we've done it sometimes with books that we kind of, they're a little bit better known or that were like not as new. But sometimes what we like to do is go find one that's like recent and buzzy and that we both just don't know anything about and dive in and see what we can, see what we make of it, you know? So I've been hearing about a novel from last year, I believe. It was a debut writer. Nobody had ever heard of her. Young woman wrote this novel that's called The Rabbit Hutch. And her name is Tess Gunty. It took off and won the National Book Award. I didn't know anything about it, except I had read somewhere that it was set in the state of Indiana, which I thought was interesting, flyover state for some people. And also, John and I have a little personal connection to Indiana because that's where our dad was from. And he was born and raised, and he kind of lived in many places, but he was a Hoosier. heart and soul. But you just don't hear about books set in Indiana very much.
No.
But we both don't really know anything about it. I'm three quarters of the way through it right now. Came out of nowhere. The writer came out of nowhere. It won a huge literary award. And it seems to have themes in it that John and I might find discussion worthy. I won't talk about them yet. So we're going to dive into that book kind of really cold, like approaching a pond in the middle of the woods. You don't know if it's freezing or warm or whatever. We're just going to both run in and dive in. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to review The Rabbit Hutch by Tess Gunty in episode 62.
And you've probably seen this, but I know even less about it than you do. So I just had to look it up to even know what we were talking about. And they're already talking movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So that's how you know, fortunately or unfortunately, that's how you know a book has sort of captured the zeitgeist when it gets snapped up, like Leave the World Behind, which we reviewed back in episode 50-something, I think, or maybe earlier than that.
No, it was earlier. It was like 36 or something like that.
But check back in the archives if you're interested. But we reviewed the book Leave the World Behind, and now it's like, I think it's literally about to drop on Netflix. As a major.
Yes. Yeah.
So this is, you know, maybe we'll be talking about the film of The Rabbit Hutch in the future. But anyway, yeah, great job. That's going to be episode 62. Look forward to the discussion, Jude. And we always look forward to bringing this podcast to you. All of you guys who are listening, thanks for doing so. Thanks for being a part of the great conversation. I think that's it.
Yeah, and yeah, thank you, everybody. We're up to 25 countries around the world. And before I say goodbye, I just want to thank John for kind of organizing the game plan around this two-parter, which I think was a really good two-parter, and all the questions for me, considering me some kind of King expert, which I'm not. But I appreciate John thinking about me in these eps, and I think he had a great concept, John, so nice job. And thanks everybody for listening.
Yeah, man, it's been a lot of fun, and I think there are a lot of King fans around the world, so hopefully they'll find something they can enjoy in this two-parter. So,
yeah, tell your friends.
Yeah, tell your friends. That's it for now. We'll talk to you all soon.
Take care, everyone.